Chapter 24. Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. 31 December, 1847. Christmas Eve and Christmas Day about HMS Terror were low-key to the point of invisibility. But the second Grand Venetian Carnival on New Year's Eve would soon make up for that. There had been 4 days of violent storms keeping the men inside in the days preceding Christmas. The blizzards were so fierce that the watches had to be shortened to 1 hour, and Christmas Eve, and the sacred day itself, became exercises in lower deck gloom. Mr. Diggle had prepared special dinners, cooking up the last of the non-canned salt pork in half a dozen imaginative ways, along with the last of the jugged hares, de-pickled from their briny casks. In addition, the cook had, with the recommendation of the quartermasters, Mr. Kenley, Mr. Rhodes, and Mr. David MacDonald, as well as the careful supervision of Surgeons Peddy and Alexander MacDonald, chosen from some of the better-preserved goldener tinned goods, including turtle soup, beef à la Flamande, truffled pheasant, and calf's tongue. For dessert both evenings, Mr. Diggle's galley slaves had cut and scraped the worst of the mould from the remaining cheeses, and Captain Crozier had contributed the last 5 bottles of brandy from the spirit room's stores set aside for special occasions. The mood stayed sepulchral. There were a few attempts to sing by both the officers in the freezing great room astern and the common seamen in their slightly warmer berthing space forward. There was not enough coal left in the hold deck scuttles for extra heating, even if it was Christmas. But the songs died after a few rounds. Lamp oil had to be conserved, so the lower deck had all the visual cheer of a Welsh mine, illuminated by a few flickering candles. Ice covered the timbers and beams, and the men's blankets and wool clothing were always damp. Rats scuttled everywhere. The brandy raised spirits some, but not enough to dispel the literal and emotional gloom. Crozier came forward to chat with the men, and a few handed him presents, a tiny pouch of hoarded tobacco, the carving of a white bear running, the exaggerated ursine cartoon face suggesting fear, given in jest, almost certainly, and probably with some trepidation, lest the formidable captain punish the man for fetishism. A mended red wool undershirt from a man's recently deceased friend, an entire carved chess set from Marine Corporal Robert Hopcraft, one of the quietest and least assuming men on the expedition, and the one who had been promoted to corporal after receiving 8 broken ribs, a fractured collarbone, and a dislocated arm during the Thing's attack on Sir John's hunting blind in June. Crozier thanked everyone, pressed hands and shoulders, and went back to the officer's mess, where the mood was a little more lively, thanks to First Lieutenant Little's surprise donation of 2 bottles of whiskey he'd kept hidden for almost 3 years. The storm stopped on the morning of 26 December. Snow had drifted 12 feet above the level of the bow and 6 feet higher than the railing along the starboard forward quarter. After digging the ship out and excavating the cairn-lined path between the ships, the men got busy preparing for what they were calling the second Grand Venetian Carnival. The first one, Crozier assumed, being the one he'd taken part in as a midshipman on Parry's botch of a polar voyage in 1824. On that midnight black morning of 26 December, Crozier and First Lieutenant Edward Little left the supervision of the shoveling and surface parties to Hodgson, Hornby and Irving, and made the long walk through the drifts to Erebus. Crozier was mildly shocked to find that Fitzjames had continued to lose weight. His waistcoat and trousers were several sizes too large for him now, despite more obvious attempts by his steward to take them in. But he was even more shocked during their conversation, when he realized that Erebus's commander was not fully paying attention most of the time. Fitzjames seemed distracted, rather like a man pretending to converse, but whose actual attention was riveted on music being played in some adjoining room.
"Your men are dying sail canvas out on the ice," said Crozier. "I saw them preparing large vats of green, blue, and even black dye. for perfectly good spare sail. Is this acceptable to you, James?
Fitzjames smiled distantly.
Do you really think we shall need that sail again, Francis?
I hope to Christ we will,
grated Crozier. The other captain's serene and maddening little smile remained.
You should see our hold deck, Francis. The destruction has proceeded and accelerated since our last inspection the week before Christmas. Erebus would not stay afloat an hour in open water. The rudder is in splinters, and it was our spare.
New rudders can be jury-rigged, said Crozier, fighting the urge to grind his teeth and clench his fists.
Carpenters can shore up sprung timbers. I've been working on a plan for digging a pit in the ice around both ships, creating dry docks about 8 feet deep in the ice itself before the spring thaw. We can get to the outer hulls that way.
Spring thaw? Repeated Fitzjames, and smiled, almost condescendingly.
Crozier decided to change the subject.
You're not worried about the men conducting this elaborate Venetian carnival?
Fitzjames defied his gentleman's heritage by shrugging.
Why should I be? I can't speak for your ship, Francis. But Christmas on Erebus was an exercise in misery. The men need something to raise their morale.
Crozier couldn't argue the point about Christmas being an exercise in misery.
But a carnival mask on the ice, during another day of total darkness, he said. How many hands will we lose to the thing waiting out there?
How many will we lose if we hide in our ships? Asked Fitzjames.
Both the small smile and the distracted air remained.
And it worked out all right when you had the first Venetian carnival under Hoppner and Parry in 24.
Crozier shook his head.
That was only 2 months after we were first frozen in, he said softly. And both Parry and Hoppner were fanatics about discipline. Even with all the frivolity and both captains' love of theatrics, Edward Parry used to say, masquerades without licentiousness, and carnivals without excess. Our discipline has not been so well maintained on this expedition, James.
Fitzjames finally lost his distracted air. Captain Crozier, he said stiffly, are you accusing me of allowing discipline to become lax aboard my ship?
No, 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 said Crozier, not knowing if he was accusing the younger man of that yet or not. I am just saying that this is our third year in the ice, not our third month as it was with Parry and Hoppner. There's bound to be some loss of discipline to go along with illness and sagging morale.
Would that not be all the more reason for allowing the men to have this diversion?
Asked Fitzjames, his voice still brittle. His pale cheeks had coloured at his superior's implied criticism. Crozier sighed.
It was too late to stop this goddamned mask now, he realised. The men had the bit in their teeth, and those on Erebus who were heading up the carnival preparations most enthusiastically were precisely those men who would be the first to foment mutiny, should the time come.
The trick as captain, Crozier knew, was never to allow that time to come. He honestly did not know whether this carnival would help or hurt that cause.
All right, he said at last, but the men have to understand that they may not waste even a lump, drop or drip of coal, lamp oil, pyroligneous fuel or ether for the spirit stoves.
They promise that it will be torches only, said Fitzjames.
And there's no extra spirits or food for that day, added Crozier. We've just gone on the severely reduced rations today. We're not changing that on the fifth day for a mask carnival that neither of us fully endorsed.
Fitzjames nodded.
Lieutenant Le Vicomte, Lieutenant Fairholme, and some of the men who are better than average rifle shots will go on hunting parties this week before the carnival in hopes of finding game. But the men understand that it is rations as usual, or rather the new reduced fare, should the hunters return empty-handed.
As they have every other time in the past 3 months, muttered Crozier.
In a friendlier voice, he said,
all right, James. I'll be getting back.
He paused at the doorway of Fitzjames's tiny cabin.
By the way,
Why are they dyeing the sails green, black, and those other colours?
Fitzjames smiled distractedly.
I have no idea, Francis.
The morning of Friday, 31 December, 1847, dawned cold but still, although, of course, there was no real dawn. Terror's morning watch under Mr. Irving registered the temperature as minus 73 degrees. There was no measurable wind. Clouds had moved in during the night and now concealed the sky from horizon to horizon. It was very dark. Most of the men seemed eager to head off to Carnival as soon as breakfast was finished, a faster meal on the new rations, consisting of a single ship's biscuit with jam and a reduced scoop of Scotch barley mush with a dollop of sugar. But all ship's duties had to be attended to, and Crozier had agreed to liberty for general attendance at the gala only after the day's work and supper were finished. Still, he'd agreed that those men without specific duties that day, holystoning the lower deck, the usual watches, de-icing the rigging, deck shoveling, ship repair, cairn repair, tutoring, could go work on final preparations for the mask, and about a dozen men headed off into the darkness after breakfast, two marines with muskets accompanying them. By noon, and the issuing of the further diluted grog, the excitement of the remaining ship's company was a palpable thing. Crozier released six more men who'd finished their day's duties and sent Second Lieutenant Hodgson along with them. That afternoon, while pacing the stern deck in the dark, Crozier could already see the bright glow of torches just beyond the largest iceberg rising between the two ships. There still was no wind or starlight. By supper time, the remaining men were as fidgety as young children on Christmas Eve. They finished their meal in record time, although with the reduced rations, since this Friday was not a flour day with baking, they were eating little more than Poor John, some Goldner canned vegetables, and two fingers of Burton's ale. And Crozier didn't have the heart to hold them in the ship while the officers finished their more leisurely mess. Besides, the remaining officers on board were as eager as the seamen to go to Carnival. Even the engineer James Thompson, who rarely showed interest in anything outside the machinery in the hold, and who had lost so much weight he resembled an ambulatory skeleton, was on the lower deck and dressed, and ready to go. So, by 7 p.m, Captain Crozier found himself bundled in every layer he could add on, making the final inspection of the eight men left to watch the ship. First Mate Hornby had the duty, but would be relieved before midnight by young Irving, who would return with three seamen so that Hornby and his watch could attend the gala. And then they were descending the ice ramp to the frozen sea and walking briskly through minus 80 degree air toward Erebus. The crowd of 30-some men soon strung out into a long line in the dark, and Crozier found himself walking with Lieutenant Irving, Ice Master Blanky, and a few petty officers. Blanky was moving slowly, using a well-padded crutch under his right arm since he'd lost the heel on his right foot, and still hadn't quite mastered walking on its wood and leather replacement, but seemed in a fine mood.
"Good evening to you, Captain," said the Ice Master. "Don't let me slow you down, sir. My mates here, Fat Wilson and Kenley and Billy Gibson, will see me there."
"You seem to be moving as fast as we are, Mr. Blanky," said Crozier. As they passed the torches lit on every fifth cairn, he noticed that there was still no breath of wind. The flames flickered vertically. The path had been well trod out, the pressure ridge gaps shoveled and hacked out to provide an easy passage. The large iceberg, still half a mile ahead of them, seemed to be lit from within by all the torches burning on the other side of it, and now resembled some phantasmagorical siege tower glowing in the night. Crozier recalled going to regional Irish fairs when he was a boy. The air tonight, while a good bit colder than an Irish summer night's, was filled with a similar excitement. He glanced behind them to make sure that Private Hammond, Private Daly, and Sergeant Tozer were bringing up the rear with their weapons at port arms and their outer mittens off.
"Strange how excited the men are about this Carnival, ain't it, Captain?" said Mr. Blanky.
Crozier could only grunt at that. This afternoon, he had drunk the last of his self-rationed whiskey. He dreaded the coming days and nights. Blanky and his mates were moving so quickly, crutch or no, that Crozier let them get ahead. He touched Irving's arm, and the gangly lieutenant dropped back from where he was walking with Lieutenant Little, Surgeons Petty and MacDonald, the carpenter Honey, and others. "John," Crozier said, when they were out of earshot of the officers, but still far enough ahead of the Marines so as not to be heard. "Any news of Lady Silence?"
"No, Captain. I checked the forward locker myself less than an hour ago, but she'd already gone out her little back door."
When Irving had reported to Crozier on their Eskimo guests' extracurricular excursions earlier in December, the captain's first instinct had been to collapse the narrow ice tunnel, seal and reinforce the ship's bows and evict the wench onto the ice once and for all. But he hadn't done that. Instead, Crozier had ordered Lieutenant Irving to assign 3 crewmen to watch Lady Silence, whenever that was feasible, and for him to follow her out onto the ice again if possible. So far, they'd not seen her go out her back door again, although Irving had spent hours hiding in the ice jumble beyond the ship's bow, waiting. It was as if the woman had seen the lieutenant during her witchly meeting with the creature on the ice, as if she had wanted him to see and hear her out there, and that had been enough. She appeared to be subsisting on ship's rations these days, and using the forward cable locker only for sleeping. Crozier's reason for not immediately evicting the native woman was simple. His men were beginning the slow process of starving to death, and they would not have adequate stores to get through the spring, much less the next year. If Lady Silence was getting fresh food from the ice in the middle of winter, trapping seals, perhaps, walrus, hopefully, it was a skill that Crozier knew his crews would have to learn in order to survive. There was not a serious hunter or ice fisherman among the 100-some survivors. Crozier had discounted Lieutenant Irving's embarrassed, heavily self-critical account of seeing something that seemed like the creature on the ice making some sort of music with the woman and bringing food offerings to her. The captain simply would never believe that Silence had trained a huge white bear, if such the thing was, to hunt and bring her fish or seal or walrus like a proper English bird dog, fetching pheasant for its master. As for the music, well, that was absurd. But she had chosen this day to go missing again.
"Well," said Crozier,
his lungs aching from the cold air, even filtered as it was through his thick wool comforter.
"When you return with the relief watch at 8 bells, check her locker again. And if she's not there, what in the name of Christ Almighty?"
They had passed through the last line of pressure ridges and come out onto the flat sea ice on the last quarter mile to Erebus. The scene that met Crozier's eyes made his jaw sag under the wool scarf and high-pulled jacket collars. The captain had assumed that the men would be having the second Grand Venetian Carnival on the flat sea ice immediately below Erebus, the way Hoppner and Parry had set their mask on the short stretch of ice between the frozen-in Hecla and Fury in 1824. But while Erebus sat bow up, dark and desolate-looking on its dirty pedestal of ice, all the light, torches, motion and commotion came from an area a quarter of a mile away, immediately in front of the largest iceberg.
"Good heavens," said Lieutenant Irving.
While Erebus looked to be a dark hulk, a new mass of rigging, a veritable city of coloured canvas and flickering torches, had risen on the bare circle of sea ice, forest of seracs, and wide open area beneath the towering, glowing iceberg. Crozier could only stand and stare. The riggers had been busy. Some, obviously, had ascended the berg itself, sinking huge ice screws deep in the ice 60 feet high on its face, pounding in bolt rings and pulley stands, adding enough rigging, running lines and blocks from the stores to outfit a 3-masted man of war at full sail. A spiderweb
of 100 ice-frosted lines ran down from the berg and back toward Erebus, supporting a city of lighted and coloured tent walls. These dyed walls of canvas, some of the mainsail sheets 30 feet high and taller, were staked to sea ice and serac and ice block, but pulled taut on their vertical spars with stays running diagonally to the tall berg. Crozier walked closer, still blinking. The ice in his eyelashes threatened to freeze his eyelids shut, but he continued blinking. It was as if a series of gigantic coloured tents had been pitched on the ice, but these tents had no roofs. The vertical walls, lighted from within and without by scores of torches, snaked from the open sea ice into the serac forest, and continued up to the vertical wall of the iceberg itself. As it was, giant rooms or coloured apartments had been erected almost overnight on the ice. Each chamber stood at an angle to the preceding chamber, a sharp turn in the rigging, staves and canvas apparent every 20 yards or so. The first chamber opened eastward onto the ice. The canvas here had been dyed a bright, rich blue, the blue of skies not seen in so many months, that the colour made a knot rise in Captain Crozier's constricted throat. And torches and braziers of flame outside the canvas chamber's vertical sides made the blue walls glow and pulse. Crozier walked past Mr. Blanky and his mates, who were staring in open wonder. "Christ," he heard the Ice Master mutter. Crozier walked still closer, actually entering the space defined by the glowing blue walls. Brightly clad and strangely garbed figures pranced and swooped around him, ragpickers with streaming comet tails of coloured cloth trailing behind them, tall chimney sweeps in death-black tails and sooty top hats doing jigs, exotic birds with long gold beaks stepping lightly, sheiks of Arabia with red turbans and pointed Persian slippers sliding along the dark ice, pirates with blue death masks pursuing a prancing unicorn, generals of Napoleon's army wearing white masks from some Greek chorus filing by in solemn procession, something dressed all in bulky green, a wood sprite, ran up to Crozier on the unslippery ice and chirped in falsetto, "The trunk of costumes is to your left, Captain. Feel free to mix and match." And then the apparition was gone, blending back into the shifting crowds of bizarrely dressed figures. Crozier continued walking deeper into the maze of coloured apartments. Beyond the blue chamber, turning sharply to the right, was a long purple room. Crozier saw that it was not empty. The men realizing this carnival had placed rugs, tapestry, tables or casks here and there in each apartment, their furnishings and fixtures dyed or painted the same hue as the glowing walls. Beyond the purple room, bending back sharply to the left here, but at such an odd angle that Crozier would have had to look at the stars, had there been any stars visible, to ascertain his exact bearings, was a long green chamber. This long room held the most revelers yet, more exotic birds, a princess with a long horse's face, creatures so segmented and oddly jointed that they appeared to be giant insects. Francis Crozier recalled none of these costumes from Parry's trunks on the Fury and Heckler, but Fitzjames had insisted that Franklin had brought precisely those mouldering old artifacts. The fourth chamber was furnished and lighted with orange. The torchlight through the thin orange-dyed canvas here seemed rich enough to taste. More orange canvas, painted and dyed to resemble tapestries, had been laid out on the sea ice, and there was a huge punch bowl on the orange-sheeted table at the centre of the interior space. At least 30 or more wildly costumed figures had converged on the punch bowl, some dipping their beaked or fanged visages to drink deeply. Crozier realized with a shock that loud music was coming from the fifth segment of the apartment maze. Following another bend to the right, he came into a white chamber.
Sheet-covered sea trunks and officers' messroom chairs had been set along the white canvas walls here, and the almost forgotten mechanical music player from Terror's Great Cabin was being cranked by a costumed fantastic at the far end of the chamber, the machine pouring out music hall favourites from its large rotating metal discs. The sound somehow seemed much louder out here on the ice. Revelers were coming out of the sixth chamber, and Crozier walked past the music player, took the sharp angle to the left, and entered a violet room. The captain's seaman's eyes admired the rigging that rose from upended spare spars to a tethered spar hanging in midair. Webs of rigging came in from the other six chambers there to be tied off, and the master cables that ran up from this center spar to anchors high on the wall of the iceberg. The riggers from Erebus and Terror, who had conceived and executed this seven-chamber maze, obviously had also exercised some of the incredible frustration at not being able to pursue their trade due to being icebound and static for so many months. Their ship's topmasts, spars, and rigging pulled down and stored on the ice. But this violet room had few costumed crewmen tarrying in it, and the light was strangely oppressive. The only furniture here consisted of stacks of empty crates at the center of the room, all draped in violet sheets. The few birds, pirates, and ragmen in this room paused to drink from their crystal goblets carried from the white room, looked around, then quickly returned to the outer chambers again. The final room beyond the violet room seemed to have no light at all coming from it. Crozier followed the sharp angle to the right from the violet chamber and found himself in a chamber of almost absolute blackness. No, that was not true, he realized. Torches burned outside the black-dyed sail walls here just as they did beyond all the other chambers, but the effect was only of a subdued glow through ebony air. Crozier had to stop to allow his eyes to adapt, and when they did, he took two startled steps backward. The ice underfoot was gone. It was as if he were walking above the black water of the Arctic Sea. It took only seconds for the captain to realize the trick. The seamen had taken soot from the boiler and coal sack holds and spread it across the sea ice here. An old seaman's trick when wanting to melt the sea ice more quickly in late spring or recalcitrant summer. But there was no melting tonight with the sunless days and temperatures dropping toward minus 100 degrees. Instead, the soot and carbon made the ice underfoot invisible in the ebony gloom of this final, terrible compartment. As Crozier's eyes adapted further, he saw that there was only one piece of furniture in the long black compartment, but his jaws clenched with anger when he saw what it was. Captain Sir John Franklin's tall, ebony grandfather clock was set at the far end of this black compartment, its back to the rising iceberg that served as the far wall to the ebony room and the end of the seven-chamber maze. Crozier could hear the heavy ticking of the thing. And above the ticking clock, extruding from the ice like something struggling to gain its freedom from the iceberg, was the white-furred head and ivory-yellow teeth of a monster. No. He checked himself again. Not a monster. The head and neck of a large white bear somehow had been mounted onto the ice. The creature's mouth was open. Its black eyes reflected the small amount of torchlight that made its way through the black-dyed canvas walls. The bear's fur and teeth were the brightest things in the ebony compartment. Its tongue was a shocking red. Beneath the head, the ebony clock ticked like a heartbeat. Filled with a fury that he could not define, Crozier marched from the ebony compartment, paused in the white room and bellowed for an officer. Any officer. A satyr with a long papier-mâché face and a priapic cone rising from its red belt scuttled forward on black metal hooves set beneath heavy boots.
Yes, sir.
Take off that fucking mask.
Aye, aye, Captain,
said the satyr, sliding the mask up to reveal Thomas R. Farr, Terror's captain of the maintop. A Chinese woman with huge breasts next to him lowered her mask to show the round, fat face of John Diggle, the cook. Next to Diggle was a giant rat, who lowered its snout enough to show the face of Lieutenant James Water Fairholme of Erebus.
"What in the hell is the meaning of all this?" roared Crozier.
Various fantastical creatures cringed back toward the white walls at the sound of Crozier's voice.
"Of which exactly, Captain?"
asked Lieutenant Fairholme.
"This!"
bellowed Crozier, raising both arms and hands to indicate the white walls, the rigging overhead, the torches, everything.
"No meaning, Captain," responded Mr. Farr. "It's simply carnival."
Crozier had always, until this moment, thought Farr a reliable and sensible hand, and a fine maintop captain.
"Mr. Farr, did you help in the rigging?" he asked sharply.
"Yes, sir."
"And Lieutenant Fairholme, were you aware of the animal's head exhibited so bizarrely in that final chamber?"
"Aye, Captain," said Fairholme.
The lieutenant's long, weathered face showed no sign of fear at his expedition commander's anger.
"I shot it myself, yesterday evening. Two of the bears, actually. A mother and its almost grown male cub. We're going to roast the meat toward midnight, have a sort of feast, sir."
Crozier stared at the men. He could feel his heart pounding in his chest, could feel the anger that, mixed with the whiskey he'd had that day, and the certainty there would be no more in the days to come, had often led him to violence ashore. He had to be careful here.
"Mr. Diggle,"
he said to the fat Chinese woman with the huge breasts,
"you know the liver of the white bears has made us ill."
Diggle's jowls bobbled up and down as freely as the pillowed bosoms beneath them.
"Oh, yes, Captain. There's something foul in the polar beast's liver that we haven't been able to heat out of it. There'll be neither liver nor lights in the feast I cook tonight, Captain, I assure thee. Only fresh meat. Hundreds and hundreds of pounds of fresh meat. Grilled and singed and fried to perfection, sir."
Lieutenant Fairholme spoke.
"The men are taking it as a hopeful omen that we blundered across the two bears on the ice and were able to kill them, Captain. Everyone's looking forward to the feast at midnight."
"Why wasn't I told of the bears?" demanded Crozier.
The officer, maintop captain, and cook looked at one another. Birds and beasts and fairies nearby looked at one another.
"The sow and cub were only shot late last night, Captain,"
Fairholme said at last.
"I guess all the traffic between the ships today has been terrors coming over to the carnival to work and get ready. No messengers from Erebus making the return trip. My apologies for not informing you, sir."
Crozier knew that it was Fitzjames who had been negligent in this regard, and he knew the men around him knew it.
"Very well," he said at last. "Carry on."
But as the men began setting their masks back in place, he added,
"And God help you if Sir John's clock is damaged in any way."
"Aye, Captain,"
said all the masked shapes around him. With a final, almost apprehensive glance back through the violet room toward the terrible black compartment, almost nothing in Francis Crozier's 51 years of frequent melancholy had oppressed him as much as that ebony compartment had. He walked from the white room to the orange room, thence from the orange room to the green room, then from the green room to the purple room, from the purple room to the blue room, and from the widening blue room out onto the darker open ice. Only when he was out of the dyed sail maze did Crozier feel that he could breathe properly. Costumed shapes gave the glowering captain a wide berth as he made his way toward Erebus and the dark, heavily cloaked figure standing at the top of the ice ramp there. Captain Fitzjames was alone near the ship's railing at the top of the ramp. He was smoking his pipe.
"Good evening to you, Captain Crozier."
"Good evening, Captain Fitzjames. Have you been inside that?
Words failed him, and Crozier gestured toward the loud and lighted city of coloured walls and elaborate rigging behind him. The torches and braziers burned bright there.
I have,
said Fitzjames. The men have shown incredible ingenuity, I would say.
Crozier had nothing to say to that.
The question now, said Fitzjames, is whether their many hours of labour and ingenuity have gone to serve the expedition or the devil.
Crozier tried to see the younger officer's eyes under the muffler-tied bill of his cap. He had no idea if Fitzjames was joking.
I warned them, growled Crozier, that they could waste not one point of oil or one extra lump of coal on this damned carnival. Just look at those fires.
The men assured me, said Fitzjames, that they are only using the oil and coal they have saved by not heating Erebus these past weeks.
Whose idea was that? Me's? Asked Crozier. The coloured compartments? The ebony room?
Fitzjames blew smoke, removed his pipe, and chuckled.
All the idea of young Richard Aylmore.
Aylmore, repeated Crozier.
He remembered the name, but hardly the man. Your gunroom steward.
The same.
Crozier recalled a small man, quiet with sunken, brooding eyes, a pedant's tone to his voice and a wispy black moustache.
Where in the hell did he come up with this?
Aylmore lived in the United States for several years before returning home in 1844 and enlisting in the Discovery Service, said Fitzjames.
The stem of the pipe clattered slightly against his teeth.
He maintains that he read an absurd story 5 years ago, in 1842, describing a masked ball just such as this, with such coloured compartments. He read it while he was living in Boston with his cousin, in a trashy little piece called Graham's Magazine, if I recall correctly. Aylmore can't remember the plot of the story exactly, but he remembers that it was about a strange masked ball given by a certain Prince Prospero, and he says that he is quite certain of the sequence of the rooms, ending in that terrible ebony compartment. The men loved his idea.
Crozier could only shake his head.
Francis, continued Fitzjames, this was a teetotaling ship for 2 years and 1 month under Sir John. Despite that, I managed to smuggle aboard 3 bottles of fine whiskey my father gave me. I have 1 bottle left. I would be honoured if you would share it with me this evening. It will be another 3 hours until the men begin cooking up the 2 bears they shot. I authorised my Mr. Wall and your Mr. Diggle yesterday to set up 2 of the whaleboat's stoves on the ice for heating incidentals such as the canned vegetables, and to build a huge grill in what they are calling the White Room for the actual cooking of the bear meat. If nothing else, it will be our first fresh meat in more than 3 months. Would you care to be my guest over that bottle of whiskey, down in Sir John's former cabin, until it's time for the feast?
Crozier nodded and followed Fitzjames into the ship. Chapter 25. Crozier. Latitude 70 degrees 5 minutes north. Longitude 98 degrees 23 minutes west. 31 December 1847 to 1 January 1848. Crozier and Fitzjames emerged from Erebus some time before midnight. The great cabin had been ferociously cold, but the deeper cold out here in the night was an assault on their bodies and senses. The wind had come up slightly in the last couple of hours, and everywhere the torches and tripod braziers. Fitzjames had suggested, and after the first hour of whiskey, Crozier had agreed, sending out extra sacks of coal and coal oil to fuel open-flame braziers to keep the revellers from freezing, were rippling and crackling in the 100-below freezing night. The two captains had talked very little, each lost in his own melancholic reverie. They'd been interrupted a dozen times. Lieutenant Irving came to report that he was taking the replacement watch back to Terra. Lieutenant Hodgson came to report that his watch had arrived at the Carnival. Other officers, in absurd costumes, came to report that all was well with Carnival itself. Various Erebus watches and officers came to report coming off duty and going on duty. Mr. Gregory, the engineer, came to report that they might as well use the coal for the braziers, since there wasn't enough to fuel the steam engine for more than a few hours of steaming, come the mythical thaw.
and then went off to make arrangements for several sacks to be hauled out to the increasingly wild ceremony on the ice. Mr. Murray, the old sailmaker, dressed as some sort of mortician with a skull under his high beaver hat, a skull not so different from his own wizened visage, begged their pardon and asked if he and his helpers could break out two spare jibs to rig a windshield upwind of the new tripod braziers. The captains had given their acknowledgements and permissions, passed along their commands and admonitions, never really rising out of their whiskey-induced thoughts. Sometime between 11 and midnight, they bundled themselves back into their outer slops, came up on deck, and then went out onto the ice again, after both Thomas Jopson and Edmund Hoare, Crozier's and Fitzjames's respective stewards, came down to the great cabin, with Lieutenants Leveconte and Little, all four men in bizarre costumes, squeezed over and under their many layers, to announce that the bear meat was being cooked up, that prime portions were being set aside for the captains, and could the captains please come to the feast now? Crozier realized that he was very drunk. He was used to holding his liquor without letting it show, and the men were used to him smelling like whiskey, while he was in complete command of situations. But he hadn't slept for several nights, and this midnight, coming out into the chest-slamming cold, and walking toward the lighted canvas and glowing iceberg and movement of strange forms, Crozier felt the whiskey burning in his belly and brain. They'd set up the main grilling area in the white room. The two captains traversed the series of compartments without comment, either to each other or to any of the dozens upon dozens of wildly costumed figures flitting about. From the open-ended blue room, they walked through the purple and green rooms, then through the orange room and into the white. It was obvious to Crozier that most of the men were also drunk. How had they done that? Had they been hoarding their allotments of grog, hiding away the ale usually served with their suppers? He knew that they hadn't broken into the spirit room aboard Terror, because he'd had Lieutenant Little check to make sure the locks were secure, both this morning and this afternoon. And Erebus's spirit room was empty, thanks to Sir John Franklin, and had been since they'd sailed. But the men had gotten into hard spirits somehow. As a seaman of more than 40 years, who had served his time before the mast as a boy, Crozier knew that, at least in terms of fermenting, hoarding, or finding alcohol, a British sailor's ingenuity knew no bounds. Huge haunches and racks of bear meat were being grilled over an open fire by Mr. Diggle and Mr. Wall, pewter plates of the steaming victuals being handed out to the queues of men by a grinning Lieutenant Leveconte, his gold tooth gleaming, and by other officers and stewards of both ships. The smell of grilling meat was incredible, and Crozier found himself salivating, despite all his private vows not to enjoy this carnival feast. The queue gave way to the two captains. Ragmen, popish priests, French courtiers, fairy sprites, motley beggars, a shrouded corpse, and two Roman legionnaires in red capes, black masks, and gold chest armour gestured Fitzjames and Crozier to the front of the queue and bowed as the officers passed. Mr. Diggle himself, his fat Chinese lady's pendulous bosoms now down around his waist and wobbling as he moved, cut a prime piece for Crozier and then another for Captain Fitzjames. Leveconte gave them proper officer's mess cutlery and white linen napkins. Lieutenant Fairholme poured ale into two cups for them.
"The trick out here, captains," said Fairholme, "is to drink quickly, dipping like a bird, so that your lips don't freeze to the cup."
Fitzjames and Crozier found a place at the head of a white-shrouded table, sitting on white-shrouded chairs, pulled back for them on the protesting ice by Mr. Farr, the captain of the maintop, whom Crozier had braced earlier in the evening. Mr. Blankey was sitting there with his ice master counterpart, Mr. Reed, as were Edward Little and a half-dozen of the Erebus officers. The surgeons clustered at the other end of the white table. Crozier took his mittens off, flexed cold fingers under wool gloves, and tried the meat gingerly,
careful not to let the metal fork touch his lips. The bear cutlet burned his tongue. He had the urge to laugh then. 100 below zero out here in the New Year's night, his breath hanging in front of him in a cloud of ice crystals. His face hidden down the tunnel of his comforters, caps and Welsh wig, and he'd just burned his tongue. He tried again, chewing and swallowing this time. It was the most delicious steak he'd ever eaten. This surprised the captain. Many months ago, the last time they tried fresh bear meat, the cooked flesh seemed gamey and rancid. The liver and possibly some of the other commonly prized organs made the men actively ill. It had been decided that the meat of the white Arctic bear would be eaten only if survival demanded it. And now this feast, this sumptuous feast, all around him in the white room, and obviously at canvas-covered casks, chests and tables in the adjoining orange and violet rooms, crewmen were wolfing down the steaks. The noise and chatter of happy men easily rose over the roar of the grill flames or the flapping of canvas as the wind came up again. A few of the men here in the white room were using knives and forks, many just spearing the steaming bear steaks and chewing on them that way. But most were using their mittened hands. It was as if more than 100 predators were reveling in their kill. The more Crozier ate, the more ravenous he became. Fitzjames, Reed, Blanky, Farr, Little, Hodgson, and the others around him, even Jopson, his steward, at a nearby table with the other stewards, appeared to be wolfing down the meat with equal gusto. One of Mr. Diggle's helpers, dressed as a baby Chinaman, came around the tables, dishing out steaming vegetables from a pan heated on one of the whaleboat's iron stoves. But the canned vegetables, however wonderfully hot, simply had no taste next to the delicious fresh bear meat. Only Crozier's position as expedition commander stopped him from muscling his way to the front of the queue and demanding another helping when he finished his heavy slab of bear steak. Fitzjames's expression was anything but distracted now. The younger commander looked as if he was about to weep from happiness. Suddenly, just as most of the men had finished the steaks and were drinking down their ale before the alcohol-rich liquid froze solid, a Persian king near the entrance to the Violet Room began cranking the musical disc player. The applause, thick mittens pounding thunderously, began almost as soon as the first note tinkled and thunked out of the crude machine. Many of the musical men aboard both ships had complained about the mechanical music player. Its range of sounds emanating from the turning metal discs was almost precisely that of a corner organ grinder's instrument. But these notes were unmistakable. Dozens of men rose to their feet. Others began singing at once, the vapor from their breaths rising in the torchlight, shining through the white canvas walls. Even Crozier had to grin like an idiot as the familiar words of the first stanza echoed off the iceberg towering above them in the freezing night. When Britain first, at heaven's command, arose from out the azure main, this was the charter of the land, and guardian angels sang this strain. Captains Crozier and Fitzjames rose to their feet and joined in the first bellowing chorus. Rule Britannia, Britannia ruled the waves. Britons never shall be slaves. Young Hodgson's pure tenor led the men in 6 of the 7 coloured compartments as they sang the second stanza. The nations not so blessed as thee shall in their turns to tyrants fall, while thou shalt flourish, great and free, the dread and envy of them all. Vaguely aware that there was a commotion 2 rooms to the east, in the entrance to the blue room, Crozier threw his head back and, warm with whiskey and bear steak, bellowed with his men. Rule Britannia! Britannia rule the waves. Britons never shall be slaves. The men in the outer rooms of the seven compartments were singing, but they were also laughing now. The commotion grew. The mechanical music player cranked louder. The men sang louder still. Even while standing and singing the third stanza between Fitzjames and Little, Crozier stared in shock as a procession entered the white room. Still more majestic shalt thou rise, more dreadful from each foreign stroke. As the loud blast that tears the skies serves but to root thy native oak. Someone led the procession in the theatrical costume version of an admiral's uniform. The epaulettes were so absurdly broad that they hung out 8 inches beyond the little man's shoulders. He was very fat. The gold buttons on his old-fashioned naval jacket would never have buttoned. He was also headless. The figure carried its papier-mâché head under the crook of his left arm, his mouldering plumed admiral's hat under his right. Crozier quit singing. The other men did not.
Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves. Britons never, never, never shall be slaves.
Behind the headless admiral, who obviously was meant to be the late Sir John Franklin, even though it had not been Sir John decapitated that day at the Bear Blind, ambled a monster 10 or 12 feet tall. It had the body and fur and black paws and long claws and triangular head and black eyes of a white Arctic bear, but it was walking on its hind legs and was twice the height of a bear and with twice the arm's length. It walked stiffly, almost blindly, swinging its upper body to and fro, the small black eyes staring at each man it approached, the swinging paws, the arms, hanging loose as bell pulls, were larger than the costumed crewmen's heads.
"That's your giant Manson on the bottom,"
laughed Erebus's second mate, Charles Frederick Deveaux, next to Crozier, raising his voice to be heard over the next stanza.
"It's your little caulker's mate, Hickey, riding on his shoulders. It took the men all night to sew up the two hides into a single costume."
The haughty tyrants ne'er shall tame.
All their attempts to bend thee down will but arouse thy generous flame, but work their woe and thy renown.
As the giant bear ambled past, dozens of men from the blue, green, and orange rooms followed it in procession through the white room and into the violet room. Crozier stood as if literally frozen to his spot near the white banquet table. Finally, he turned his head to look at Fitzjames.
"I swear I did not know, Francis," said Fitzjames.
The other captain's lips were pale and very thin.
The white room began emptying of costumed figures, as the scores there followed the headless admiral and the swinging, towering, slowly ambling bipedal bear giant into and through the relative gloom of the long violet room.
The drunken singing roared around Crozier.
Rule Britannia! Britannia rule the waves! Britons never, 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 never shall be slaves!
Crozier began following the procession into the violet chamber, and Fitzjames followed him. The captain of HMS Terror had never felt this way in all of his years of command. He knew that he had to stop this travesty of a lampoon. No naval discipline could tolerate a farce in which the death of the expedition's former commander became a source of humor. But at the same time, he knew that it had already proceeded to a point where simply shouting down the singing, ordering Manson and Hickey out of their obscene monster suit, ordering everyone out of their costumes and back to their berths on the ships, would be almost as absurd and useless as the pagan ritual Crozier was watching with growing anger.
To thee belongs the rural reign. Thy cities shall with commerce shine,
All thine shall be the subject main, and every shore it circles thine.
The headless admiral, ambling bear thing, and the following procession of 100 costumed men or more had not paused long in the violet room. As Crozier entered the violet-coloured space, the torches and outside tripod fires were whipping on the north side of the violet-dyed canvas wall, and the sails themselves were rippling and cracking in the rising wind. He arrived just in time to see Manson and Hickey and their singing mob pause at the entrance to the ebony room. Crozier resisted the impulse to shout out, "No!" It was an obscenity for the effigy of Sir John and the towering bear thing to play this out in any forum, but unthinkably vile in that black, oppressive ebony room, with its polar bear head and ticking clock. Whatever final dumb show the men had in mind, at least it would soon be finished. This had to be the finale of this ill-thought-out mistake of a second grand Venetian carnival. He would let the singing end of its own, the pagan mime closed to drunken cheers from the men, and then he would order the mobs out of their costumes, send the frozen and drunken seamen back to their ships, but order the riggers and organizers to strike the canvas and rigging immediately, tonight. Whether that meant frostbite or no, he would then deal with Hickey, Manson, Aylmore, and his officers. The swaying, much-cheered headless admiral and swaying bear monster entered the ebony compartment. Sir John's black clock within began striking midnight. The mob of bizarrely costumed sailors at the rear of the procession began pressing forward. The rear ranks, eager to get into the ebony compartment, to see the fun, even while the ragmen, rats, unicorns, dustmen, one-legged pirates, Arab princes and Egyptian princesses, gladiators, fairies and other creatures at the front of the mob, already making the turn and crossing the threshold into the black room, began resisting the advance, pushing back, no longer sure they wanted to be in that soot-floored and black-walled darkness. Crozier elbowed his way forward through the mob, the mass surging forward and then back as those in the front thought twice about actually entering the ebony gloom, certain now that if he couldn't end this farce before the finale, at least he could shorten this final act. He'd no sooner entered the darkness with 20 or 30 men at the front of the procession, who'd also halted upon stepping in. His eyes had to adapt in here, and the black soot on the ice gave him a terrible sense of falling into a black void. When he felt the blast of cold air against his face, it was as if someone had opened a door in the wall of the iceberg that loomed over everything. Even the costumed figures here in the dark were still singing, but the real volume came from the pushing mobs still back in the violet room.
"Rule Britannia! Britannia rule the waves! Britons never, 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 never shall be slaves."
Crozier could only just make out the white of the disembodied bear's head emerging from the ice over the ebony clock. The chimes had struck 6 now and seemed terribly loud in the darkened space. And he could see that under the taller, swaying, white bear monster's form, Manson and Hickey were finding it difficult to keep their balance on the sooty ice, in the icy blackness, with the north canvas walls flapping and rippling wildly with the wind. Crozier saw that there was a second large white shape in the room. It also stood on its hind legs. It was farther back in the darkness than Manson and Hickey's bear-hide white glow, and it was much larger and taller. As the men fell silent and the clock was striking its last 4 chimes, something in the room roared.
"The muses, still with freedom found, shall to the happy coast repair, blessed isle with matchless beauty crowned and manly hearts to guide the fair."
Suddenly, the men in the ebony room were shoving backward against the still-pushing throng of seamen trying to get in.
"What in God's name?" asked Dr. MacDonald.
The 4 surgeons,
all in harlequin costumes, but with their masks hanging down now, were recognizable to Crozier in the brighter violet glow coming around the canvased curve between the rooms. A man in the ebony room screamed in terror. There came a second roar, unlike anything that Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier had ever heard. It was something more at home in a thick jungle of some previous Hyborian age than in the Arctic of the 19th century. The sound ground so low into the bass regions, grew so reverberating and emerged so ferocious that it made the captain of HMS Terror want to piss his pants right there in front of his men. The larger of the two white shapes in the gloom charged forward. Costumed men screamed, tried to push backward against the wave of the forward-pushing curious, and then ran to the left and right in the darkness, colliding with the nearly invisible black-dyed canvas walls. Crozier, unarmed, stood where he was. He felt the mass of the thing brush past him in the darkness. He sensed it with his mind, felt it in his head. There was a sudden stench, as of old blood, then the reek of a carrion pit. Princesses and fairies were throwing off costumes and cold weather slops in the darkness, clawing at the black walls and fumbling for their boat knives on their buried belts. Crozier heard a meaty, sickening slap as huge plate-sized paws or knife-sized claws slammed into a man's body. Something crunched sickeningly as teeth longer than bayonet blades bit through skull or bone. In the outer rooms, men still sang.
Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves. Britons never, 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 never shall be slaves.
The ebony clock concluded its striking. It was midnight. It was 1848. Men used their knives to slash through the black-dyed walls, and strips of wind-tormented canvas were immediately whipped into the flames of torches and tripods out on the ice. Flames leapt skyward and almost immediately engaged the rigging. The white shape had moved out into the violet room. Men there were screaming and scattering, cursing and shoving, some already slashing at the walls there rather than trying to make the long run out through the compartment maze, and Crozier shoved seamen aside as he tried to follow. Both walls of the ebony room were ablaze now. More men screamed, and one man ran past Crozier, his harlequin costume, Welsh wig and hair, shooting flames behind him, like yellow silk streamers. By the time Crozier shoved himself free of the surging mob of fleeing, costumed forms, the violet compartment was also burning, and the thing from the ice had moved on to the white room. The captain could hear the shouts from scores of men as they ran ahead of the white apparition in a wave of waving arms and shed costumes. The web of beautifully rigged ropes attaching the canvas and spar struts to the overhanging iceberg was burning now. The patterns of flame slashing like scribbled runes of fire against the black slate of sky. The 100-foot wall of ice reflected the flames in its 1,000 facets. The spars themselves, that rose like exposed ribs along the burning walls of the ebony room, the violet room, and now the white room, were also on fire. Years of storage in the virtual desert of the Arctic dryness had leached all moisture from the wood. They fed the flames like 1,000-pound pieces of tinder. Crozier gave up all hope of mastering the situation and ran with the others. He had to get out of the burning maze. The white room was fully engaged. Flames shot up from the white walls, from the canvas carpets on the ice, from the former sheet-draped banquet tables and casks and chairs, and from Mr. Diggle's metal cooking grill. Someone had knocked over the mechanical disc player in their panicked flight, and the oak and bronze instrument reflected the flames from all of its beautifully crafted faces and curves. Crozier saw Captain FitzJames standing in the white room, the only figure not costumed and not running. He grabbed the motionless man by his slop's sleeve.
Come, James, we have to go.
The commander of HMS Erebus slowly turned his head and looked at his superior officer as if they had never met. FitzJames had that small, absent, maddening smile on his face again.
Crozier slapped him. Come on!
Pulling and tugging the sleepwalking FitzJames, Crozier stumbled through the burning white room, out through the fourth room, whose walls were more orange with flames than with dye now, and into the burning green room. The maze seemed to go on and on. Costumed figures lay on the ice here and there, some moaning and with ripped and mauled vestments, one man naked and burned. But other seamen were stopping to help them up, shoving them onward and outward. The sea ice underfoot, where there were no burning canvas carpets, was littered with shreds of costumes and abandoned cold weather gear. Most of these tatters and fabrics were either ablaze or the about to burn.
Come on,
repeated Crozier, still tugging a stumbling FitzJames in his wake. A seaman lay unconscious on the ice. Young George Chambers from Erebus, Crozier saw, one of the ship's boys, although 21 now, one of the drummers in their early burials on the ice, and no one seemed to be taking notice of him. Crozier released FitzJames just long enough to lift Chambers over his shoulder, and then he grabbed the other captain's sleeve again and began running, just as flames on either side exploded to the rigging above. Crozier heard a monstrous hissing behind him. Certain that the thing had circled behind him in the confusion, perhaps crashing up through the impenetrable ice, he swung to confront it with only his one mittened fist free. The entire iceberg was steaming and popping from the heat. Huge chunks and heavy overhangs were breaking off and crashing down to the ice, hissing like snakes as they fell into the cauldron of flame that had been the tent maze. The sight held Crozier in motionless rapture for a minute. The berg's countless facets reflecting the flames made him think of a 100-story fairy tale castle tower ablaze with light. He knew at that instant that as long as he lived, he would never again see anything like this.
Francis, lisped Captain James FitzJames, we have to go.
The green room's walls were falling away, but there were only more flames on the ice beyond. The rapidly advancing fissures and tendrils and fingers of fire had spread to the final two compartments. Shielding his face with his free hand, Crozier charged forward through the flames, herding the last of the fleeing revelers on ahead of him. Out through the burning purple room staggered the survivors as Crozier led them into the blazing blue room. The wind from the northwest was howling now, joining with screams and roars and hisses that might have been only in Francis Crozier's head for all he knew at that moment. And the flames were blowing across the blue compartment's wide opening, creating a barrier of fire. A cluster of about a dozen men, some still wearing shreds of their costume finery, had slid to a stop before those flames.
Move!
Roared Crozier, bellowing in his most commanding typhoon voice. A lookout in the cross trees at the top of a mainmast 200 feet above the deck could have heard the command clearly in an 80-knot wind with 40-foot waves crashing around them. And he would have obeyed. These men also obeyed, jumping, screaming, and running through the flames with Crozier right behind them, still carrying Chambers along on his right shoulder and tugging FitzJames along with his left hand. Once outside, his slops steaming, Crozier continued running, catching and passing some of the dozens of men who were spreading out in every direction in the night. The captain did not immediately see the white creature among the men, but everything was very confused out here, even with the flames throwing light and shadows 500 feet in every direction. And then he was busy, shouting for his officers and trying to find an ice boulder on which to lay the still unconscious George Chambers. Suddenly, There came the pop, pop, pop of musket fire.
Incredibly, unbelievably, obscenely, a line of four Marines just outside the circle of light from the flames had taken their knees on the ice and were firing into the clumps and mobs of running men. Here and there a figure, still sadly and absurdly in costume, fell to the ice. Releasing Fitzjames, Crozier ran forward, stepping into the line of volley fire and waving his arms. Musket balls whizzed past his ears.
"Cease fire! God damn your eyes, Sergeant Hosier! I'll break you to a private for this, and have you hanged if you don't cease that fucking fire immediately!"
The firing popped and stopped. The Marines snapped to a standing salute. Sergeant Tozer shouting that the white thing was out there among the men. They'd seen it, backlit by the flames. It was carrying a man in its jaws. Crozier ignored him, shouting and shoving both Terrors and Erebuses into clumps around him on the ice, sending obviously mauled or burned men back to Fitzjames's nearby ship. The captain was hunting for his officers, or Erebus officers, or anyone he could give an order to and have it relayed to the clusters of terrified men, still running out through the seracs and across pressure ridges into the howling Arctic darkness. If those men didn't come back, they'd freeze to death out there, or the thing would find them. Crozier decided that no one was going the mile back to Terra until they had warmed up on the lower deck of Erebus. But first, Crozier had to get his men calmed, organized, and busy, pulling the wounded and the bodies of the dead from what was left of the burning carnival compartments. In the first moments, he found only the Erebus mate Couch and Second Lieutenant Hodgson. But then Lieutenant Little came up through the smoke and steam. The top few inches of ice were melting in an irregular radius around the flames and sending a thick fog out across the sea ice and into the Serac forest. Saluted clumsily, his right arm was burned, and reported for duty. With Little at his side, Crozier found it easier to gain control of the men, get them back toward Erebus, and start taking roll. He ordered the Marines to reload and set them in a defensive skirmish line between the accumulating mass of staggering men near Erebus's ice ramp and the still roaring inferno.
"My God!"
said Dr. Harry D. S. Goodsir, who had just come out of the Erebus and was standing nearby, tugging off his slops and greatcoat.
"It's actually warm out here with the flames."
"So it is," said Crozier, feeling the sweat on his face and body. The fire had brought the temperature up 100 degrees or more. He wondered idly if the ice would melt and they'd all drown. To Goodsir, he barked,
"Go over there to Lieutenant Hodgson and tell him to begin to assess the numbers of dead and wounded and to get them to you. Find the other surgeons and get Erebus's sick bay fitted out in Sir John's great room. Set it up as they trained you surgeons to do for a combat engagement at sea. I don't want the dead laid out on the ice. That thing is still out here somewhere. So tell your seamen to carry them to the forepeak on the lower deck. I'll check in on you in 40 minutes. Have a complete butcher's bill ready for me."
"Aye, Captain,"
said Goodsir, grabbing up his outer clothes. The surgeon rushed towards Lieutenant Hodgson and the ice ramp to Erebus. The canvas and rigging and ice-set masts and costumes and tables and casks and other furniture in the inferno that had been the seven coloured compartments continued to burn all through that night and deep into the darkness of the next morning.